Well, tonight is one of those makings of those coast-to-coast programs that you want to record and listen to for the rest of your life. Because in a moment, there's going to be an individual joining us who, I think outside of Dr. J. Allen Hynek, the late Dr. Hynek, brings to us some incredible thoughts, theories about the field of ufology and about some other issues that we'll talk with him about as well. Their very world-renowned Jacques Vallée joins us on Coast to Coast AM. Well, one of the most prolific, best-selling, and most quoted authors in the field of ufology, also entrepreneur, Jacques Vallée, a senior researcher at the DARPA-funded Augmentation Research Center at SRI in the beginning of the remote viewing program initiated by Dr. Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ in 1971. Given his long-standing interest in consciousness research, he became informally associated with the program, credited by the great Ingo Swann for suggesting the approach that led to the coordinate remote viewing protocol. In the mid-80s, Dr. Vallée was brought back to SRI as a consultant. He was cleared for grill flame, went through formal training with Ingo Swann, and his experience spans the entire life of the program and gives him a special position as an observer and commentator on the reality of remote viewing. Dr. Vallée also has been long interested, as I mentioned, in the UFO phenomenon. If you remember the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, there was a figure there by Lacombe, was his name, in the movie, Steven Spielberg's classic, playing the part of Jacques Vallée. Our privilege to introduce to you tonight Jacques Vallée. Jacques, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure to be on the program.
Oh, my gosh. I have wanted to talk with you for close to 15 years. Can you believe that? It's a long time pursuing you.
I've stayed away from the field for many years. I've continued to do research, of course. I'm privileged to have a number of readers and associates who have formed a sort of network, and we continue to investigate cases. But I've stayed away from most of the public debate because it's turned from what was initially a scientific exploration to belief systems that are quarreling all over the place, and it's difficult to do science in that environment. And I'm still looking for the answers.
By basically backing off the field of ufology, was it frustrating for you to have to do that? Because at the time, there was no one other than you and Dr. Hynek, who of course is one of your mentors, both of you astronomers. You were there. I mean, wherever I went, Jacques, and heard about UFO cases and issues, it was always you. And even though you changed your theories, and we'll talk about that this hour before we get into the remote viewing with Paul Smith tonight, even though you changed some of your views on that, you were still the one that everybody went to or talked to. And the fact that you backed off all that, was that difficult for you?
Well, not really. I think in science, it makes sense to go through different phases. There are phases of debate and open discussion and so on, and then you have to go back. And Dr. Hynek used to quote the Chinese proverb, there is a time to fish and a time to mend your nets. And so I've been mending my nets. And what I like to do is to refrain from jumping to conclusions. And it's very tempting to jump to conclusions, especially when you have a phenomenon that's so tantalizing and so has been around so long. And it's frustrating, and it's tempting to just jump to a particular belief system. I've tried not to do that. And what I like to do is just listen to witnesses. And that's how I learn, because they were there and I wasn't. So I try to listen to them, and I try to help them make sense of what they've seen.
The fact that you're participating in remote viewing in a pretty big way again, you're on this program, does that mean that Jacques Vallée is coming back? Or is this just a special, isolated case?
I've agreed to give the keynote speech at that conference on remote viewing in Las Vegas next month at the invitation of Paul, you know, Paul Smith and Ingo Swann. I have a lot of respect for these men, and I've learned a lot from them. I consider that subject as somewhat unrelated to the UFO subject, and I certainly don't consider myself a parapsychologist. There are a number of professional people in that field who spend all their time doing experiments. I'm not one of them. I'm an interested observer. And I had the privilege of working especially with Dr. Putoff and with Ingo in the early days of the program, and I've tried to make a contribution to it.
I don't know if you ever came across some of the work of my aunt, who was very close to Ingo Swann at the time, Dr. Shafika Karegula.
Yes.
And she wrote the book Breakthrough to Creativity.
Yes.
That was my aunt. And life was snuffed out in her very early. I've always wondered, Jacques, what her specific field and interest would be, because she was into telepathy and she was getting into remote viewing. And I thought she was one of the greatest scientists around. Had her life not been cut short, who knows what could have happened with her.
No, remote viewing has a long history. At the turn of the century, the previous century, you know, in the early 1900s, there was a lot of research in Europe, and some research by especially a man named Varcolier in France at an institute called the Metapsychic Institute in France, which is still in existence. And it's a lot of the pioneering work. And it's a field that has a long and distinguished history.
I'm going to bring Paul Smith in with you next hour, and he's going to stay with us for the rest of the show as we talk about remote viewing and some of the work that is going on. And we'll take just the moments tonight in this hour that will go by very fast to talk about your career, how you got going. You had observed, I think at an early age, did you not, a UFO case? Isn't that what got you interested in this?
Yes. In 1955, and I was 16 actually, and my mother was working in the yard, and she saw something in the sky and called me. I rushed down the stairs to join her, and we saw an object that, you know, I can only describe as looking like a saucer. What made me take that seriously, because it could have been something seen, an airplane seen from a particular angle or a strange prototype or something. But a friend of mine, who was a physics student, was about a mile away up on the hill, and he told me the next day that he had seen it and he had watched it with binoculars. So that object was seen long enough for all of us to get a good look at it, and his description was absolutely consistent with ours. I've never, at the time, I sort of convinced myself, as many witnesses do, that this must be just, you know, one of those things. And then several years later, of course, I was trained in astronomy in France, and my first job was at Paris Observatory, tracking satellites. This was in the very early days of the space program, mm-hmm. when there were very few satellites visible in the sky. And all of us on the team saw an object that was retrograde. In other words, it was going around the Earth in the reverse of what is the easiest trajectory for a satellite. In those days, there was no rocket powerful enough to launch a retrograde satellite around the Earth. And it was very bright. We tracked it. We got 11 data points on it. And we were excited because it could have been, you know, an asteroid that was captured by the Earth that was in orbit, and we were excited about computing an orbit. The man in charge of the project confiscated the tape and erased it. And that's really what got me to re-examine the whole thing, because in I had always thought if there were UFOs, astronomers would see them and astronomers would tell us. And here we were at Paris Observatory, a team of astronomers seeing something we could not explain. And it might have been natural, but it certainly was very, very unusual. It was seen by other teams on successive nights, and we were destroying the data. And in astronomy, you never destroy the data because you may be seeing something that's not going to happen again for 200 years. And
what compelled him,
Jacques? You keep the data.
What compelled him to destroy the data?
I've pondered that. I think it was not so much a cover-up as it was fear of ridicule. I told him, why didn't we send that to the Americans? In those days, under the geophysical year agreements, all scientists were pooling their data on satellites. And he said, well, the Americans would laugh at us. And I think people in this country don't realize the prestige of American science is such that if American scientists say something doesn't exist, well, it doesn't exist, and people will destroy their data because they don't want to be laughed at. Later on, of course, Dr. Hynek showed me some data that he had saved from the satellite program. Of course, he was the one who instituted the satellite tracking program for the U.S. after Sputnik, and some of that data was on the same nights of the same object we had seen.
So as you got into trying to validate the, at that time, the popular extraterrestrial views, you changed your views a little bit. We'll talk about that in a moment. But with your association with Dr. Hynek, did you know him when he was the consultant for Project Blue Book, when he was sort of like a skeptic until he changed?
When Dr. Hynek was someone of great intelligence and tremendous open mind, and he had gotten into science because he was interested in the limitations of science. He was not pompous at all. He was not one of those scientists who tried to explain everything. On the contrary, he was fascinated with mysteries, and of course that's what drew him to astronomy in the first place. He had to be a skeptic because he had the data he had seen from the Air Force in the early days was not strong data. It was interesting enough that he remained involved in it, but he was always waiting for the case or proverbial proof of the phenomenon, and that did not happen. So he was always sort of skeptically reviewing the data, but he was interested enough that he traveled to France, for example, to meet Aimé Michel and Pierre Guérin, who were two of the people who had done extensive studies of the phenomenon in France. And of course, the European data was extremely rich. And he came back very puzzled when I met him. I joined his team at Northwestern in 1963. He was, at that point, the scientific consultant for Project Blue Book. And I showed him the European data, case after case after case. And I told him, look, the phenomenon must be the same in the U.S., except it's not recorded properly. Because people are afraid of reporting certain things to the Air Force. Some of the data is being censored by some of the ufologists themselves. Many people didn't want to talk about close encounters, or what we were calling landings, and that Dr. Hynek called later close encounters. And I think that's what changed his mind.
Did that metamorphosis surprise you? And you might have been responsible for him to change.
Yes, he gave me credit for changing his mind, but what changed his mind was seeing the patterns emerge. My wife and I had done the first computer catalog of cases. It was about 3,000 cases, selected cases, and the I'm an information scientist. I was trained in physics, but my career has been in information science. So I tend to look for patterns in things. One particular case doesn't really prove anything. There is a, the skeptics are always saying, well, give us your best case and we'll take it apart. There is no such thing as one best case in any field. You have to look at an accumulation of cases and look for patterns, and then that's how the phenomenon reveals itself to you. And that's what we went through. Of course, the clincher was that Dr. Heine gave me access to the Air Force files, the Blue Book files, which were largely unclassified. People always talk about, the secret files of Project Blue Book. Well, there were a few classified cases that I couldn't see, but most of the cases were open, and those were the ones that I was really interested in, and I was able to show him that the patterns were the same. In fact, there were more landing cases in the Air Force files than there were in the files of NICAP, which was one of the ufology groups, because at that point, ufologists were afraid of looking silly. So they were pre-selecting data that was not too strange. And of course, you have to take, I believe you have to take data the way it is. And if it is strange, if it looks strange, you have to deal with it. That's true in any science. There are many strange phenomena in physics, and you can't shy away from it.
In your work, specifically Passport to Magonia, I noticed the change of people, your mindset to what are these UFOs? Are these people, are these beings extraterrestrial? You started changing. What caused that change, Doctor?
Well, in the early days, I think that's true for most of us in the field. You enter the field and with some arrogance, especially the arrogance of, a young scientist, which I was at the time. And you think, well, nobody has really done the research. And if I apply the tools I know, the tools of physics and computer science and so on, to this database of all these sightings, obviously these people are not lying. Obviously they've seen something extremely unusual. In a year or two, I'll be able to solve it. And so you make a list of hypotheses. This is obviously not a natural phenomenon. And the extraterrestrial explanation seemed to be the best one. Why shouldn't we know that there's got to be life throughout the universe. So why shouldn't it be able to come here, especially since there must be civilizations there that are thousands, if not millions of years ahead of us. So it looks like a very likely hypothesis, and it still is one of the hypotheses we have to consider. But then as you get more and more data, you realize that's not what the witnesses are describing. What the witnesses are describing is something that, in many cases, comes out of nowhere, disappears into nowhere. There are cases of objects becoming transparent on the spot, physical objects, material objects. And I have no question that people have said, well, the valet doesn't believe this is physical. Well, of course it is physical. It's material at some times, but it can also change shape. It can also merge with other objects, and it can also disappear on the spot. Well, if it does that, then it could be from anywhere, anytime.
Jacques, stay with us. We'll be right back with you. We'll continue this incredible discussion with you. Also, you wrote a paper about 5 arguments against the extraterrestrial origin of unidentified flying objects. We'll talk about that as well. Fascinating. Dr. Jacques Vallée, our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you haven't subscribed yet to the After Dark newsletter, go ahead and do so. First of all, you'll get an old Art Bell CD, an interview with Al Bielek of the Philadelphia Experiment. It's one of those old-time classics. That's yours as a gift when you subscribe or renew your After Dark subscription And because Al's come into some hard financial times lately, we're making a donation to him for every renewal or every new subscription. So call 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online at coasttocoastam.com. Now, when we come right back, Dr. Jacques Vallée on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Dr. Jacques Vallée. Next hour, Paul Smith, remote viewer, will join us for the rest of the program with Dr. Vallée as well. Doctor, in the book, Passport to Magonia, it is, Magonia, of course, is a magical land in French folk tales. Is that how you got the name for the book?
Yes. I was, after I wrote my first two books, and I wrote those books out of a feeling that I had a collection of data that was filtered, that was verified, and that I should make it available to other researchers. So once I had done that, I certainly felt a sense of relief that I had at least done my duty to my fellow researchers. And then I started looking at some of the things that didn't fit. And one of the things that, you know, I had to ask is, when did this actually start? Every UFO book starts with, you know, on June 24, 1947, Kenneth Arnold saw something about Ukraine and so on. Well, that's not really true. I mean, we have data from the 30s and the 20s and from 1896 and 1897 all over the United States, and then you can go back in history. And many people don't want to hear that. They want to hear that this is, you know, if you follow the first level extraterrestrial theory, then ETs, you know, discovered us when the atom bomb went off and they came here to study us. Well, that's not what the data says. So when did it start? And I found, an enormous wealth of data going back to medieval times and even before. Of course, as you go back in history, you lose the cultural context, and it's harder to understand the data. But in medieval times, there were records, especially the records of the church, that were kept very, very carefully about strange phenomena. And from those records, we've been able to find out how many comets were seen, the frequency of meteors, even other natural cycles. And the term Magonia came from the writings of the Archbishop of Lyon in the 9th century. He was writing against the superstitions of the time. He was a skeptic. And he said that one of the things that people believed around Lyon was that there was a magical land above the clouds, which is where the cloud ships came from. Well, what cloud ships? Well, those were obviously physical things that people saw coming from the sky. Not only that, but there were people coming out of those cloud ships. And he said one day the crowd in Lyon brought him four people, three men and one woman, in chains that they had captured coming out of one of those cloud ships, and they thought they were witches. So they were going to kill them. And he preached to the crowd that this could not, that they could not have come out of a cloud ship because there was no such thing. And of course, he was arguing as a theologian that witches did not have enough power to affect the weather and atmospheric phenomena, that this was something that would take away from the majesty of God. And that was his argument against the superstitions of the time and against Magonia. And I thought it was such a great story that I called my book Passport to Magonia.
Well, wonderful. And in Messengers of Deception, another fine work by you, the change was occurring where you were shifting from what conventional ufologists believe UFOs may be and extraterrestrials into this other area where you began to tie in psychic phenomena, angels, ghosts, occults. You began to see that. What was it that really started that shift for you?
Well, it's the realization that we deal with a phenomenon that is extraordinarily complex. And again, I start from what the witnesses tell me, not from hypotheses.
Right.
The hypotheses have to come later, but you know, these people are sincere. As you know, I've traveled all over the world. I've spoken to people on several continents, traveled all over the U.S. And I try to listen carefully to what people tell me. It's a very complex phenomenon. So if you let me, or if you let anybody select data for a particular theory, of course you can prove anything you want. The problem is we shouldn't be doing that. We should take the whole phenomenon with all its complexity. And it includes reports from people, for example, that strange phenomena have happened in connection or before or immediately after what they perceived as a UFO sighting. And that includes a change in consciousness. And of course, by then, I was introduced to the SRI program on remote viewing, and I'd always been interested in the phenomena of consciousness and parapsychology. Mm-hmm. And that is definitely part of the overall phenomenon. So that opens a whole other layer of study of and possible hypotheses about UFOs.
The incredible movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Spielberg's movie based on Dr. Hynek's book of the same title, and all of it. But the Frenchman in the movie was based on you. And how did that happen? How was that evolution?
When I met with Mr. Spielberg, he told me that he had been thinking about that movie ever since he was a teenager. In fact, he had played with UFO imagery with a 16 millimeter camera a long time before, and he had it was amusing that he had read my books. So he thought that he thought it was funny that there would be a Frenchman trying to investigate UFOs in the United States, and that that it's as an alien, but not quite the same kind of alien. And he thought it would be nice to have a character based on that. So he
what did you think?
Character on me.
When you went to the, I'm sure you've seen the movie.
Oh yeah.
What did you think of basically you being that part?
Well, it wasn't so much me, but François Truffaut is somebody I've always admired. I was introduced to Mr. Spielberg by Marsha Seligson, who was a writer and journalist in Los Angeles. We had lunch a couple of times, and I tried to argue that if the aliens in the movie were not extraterrestrial, it would be even more interesting. But of course, that was not what the public expected, and it's a lot easier to think of UFOs as being strictly extraterrestrial. Again, if we listen to the witnesses, we have to open up the spectrum of hypotheses beyond that. It's only one hypothesis among many.
But you found it to be an entertaining movie?
Oh, yes.
Fun?
Oh, yes. And again, François Truffaut is tremendous in the movie. I love the part where he keeps going around trying to tell the military that this is a sociological phenomenon. And among other things, it is. And of course, the movie hinges on remote viewing.
It sure does. I had heard that you tried to convince Spielberg later to do another movie based on the fact that, this is different. This could be much more than just extraterrestrials from other planets.
Well, there is another movie waiting to be made, but it would have to be made carefully to match the complexity of the phenomenon and something that's scientifically valid. But yes, I think there is another movie to be made at some point.
Those who believe, Jacques, that we might have been seeded from extraterrestrials, regardless of where they come from, do you accept that theory, that possibility?
I'm not a biologist. I'm not a molecular biologist. We don't know where DNA came from. The components of DNA are, of course, natural, natural elements. But those natural elements are found throughout the universe. It's possible that even that life could have appeared first on Mars. Again, it's not my own theory. It's a theory that people are seriously considering. We know that the collisions of asteroids with Mars could have ejected material that could have landed on Earth. And scientists have recovered Martian meteorites, especially in Antarctica, where it's easiest to find them. And there is still a debate about whether those meteorites may contain traces left by ancient life. So a lot of speculation is possible, a lot of hypotheses. The components of DNA or even bits of DNA itself could have come from the cosmos. That doesn't mean we were seeded by any intelligent species. It could be a natural phenomenon, but life could have first appeared outside the Earth and been projected to the Earth by meteorites.
The change in your thoughts, of course, went contrary to what the mainstream, if you can call it mainstream, ufologists would think of extraterrestrial life. Did they kind of shun you when that metamorphosis occurred?
Well, that's all right. You know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. I think
sure.
That's the way, you know, research has to work. Similar with the skeptics, you know, the skeptics just don't want to look at the facts, and that's fine too. I think those are the same people who didn't want to believe that artificial satellites could be useful in science, same people who said computers were a waste of time. And, so, you know, those things change with time. I can understand people saying, look, if it's not terrestrial, it's got to be extraterrestrial. And that's a simple-minded approach to it. Well, it could be. It could be lots of other things. What the phenomenon is really saying is that we don't understand space and time. And that's really what's very, very interesting to me, is that it's an opportunity to learn something and to do some good physics and to look at new models in physics.
You came up with an incredible hypothesis in 1990 called Five Arguments Against the Extraterrestrial Origin of Unidentified Flying Objects. Let's just take a few moments while we have time this hour before we bring Paul Smith on. These are incredible points. I mean, you talked about unexplained close encounters are far more numerous than required for physical survey of the Earth. What do you mean of that?
Well, I didn't do a good job of explaining why I wrote that paper. People have assumed that, well, if I call the paper Five Arguments Against the Extraterrestrial Theory, it means that I don't believe in UFOs.
Right.
Of course, that's not the case at all. In science, when you have an hypothesis, you must look at the things that contradict your hypothesis. That's the first rule. You can't just lobby people to believe the same thing you believe. That's not the way science works. It would be a little bit too easy. This is not politics. This is science. So my question was, what are the things that any extraterrestrial theory has to account for to be a valid theory? And one of the there are a number of problems, you know, without going into all the details.
Sure.
First, this is not a new phenomenon. This is a phenomenon that, as far as we can tell, has been with us throughout human history. It's much more complex and diverse than a survey of the Earth by some civilization coming here. The appearance of the beings is consistent with human beings. Their appearance is somewhat different, but the witnesses say they can read emotions on their faces. These beings have two legs and two arms and one head with pretty much the same organs we do. Any biologist, and I've had extensive discussions with zoologists, and I advised them, was it a foregone conclusion that human beings would be the dominant intelligent species on Earth? And the answer is absolutely not. The octopus could could have developed into something much more intelligent than human beings.
I think the dolphin has.
Dolphins, yeah. Birds, some birds, the use of tools by birds is remarkable. And they did not develop into the most dominant or intelligent species, but that's probably an accident. And we don't know what's going to happen after the human race. And certainly we would not expect, and people have disagreed with me, and you know, in honest disagreement about this, but you would not expect a creature from evolution on another planet to look so similar to us. So it could still be extraterrestrial, but you need to expand the assumptions you're making about it. And then there is a number, as you were saying, the sheer number of landings. We know that only one case in 10 or 20 is ever reported. And we know that if the occurrences are independent of a witness being there, which would be the case in a survey of the Earth, then we need to extrapolate for the fact that people go to bed at night and that there are no observers out there. And you reach numbers that are extraordinary. And with the technology we have now, if we were to explore a planet that had life on it, intelligent life, we could do it with something, you know, the size of a small car in orbit around that planet, and we might land a few times, but we certainly would not need to deploy the kind of technology that seems to be deployed here, if it's a technology.
And you know, their ability, their whatever propulsion system or their ability to manipulate space to get here, to me, probably points out the fact that there's something here that we really don't understand, that is way beyond the simple extraterrestrial theories that we used to listen to years ago.
And that's what really keeps me going. That's why I haven't given up on the field. I love technology. My business is high technology. I have people in my office every day teaching me new things about technology and showing me that things I thought were impossible are now achievable. And so this phenomenon is a fascinating challenge. The idea that they have to be either terrestrial or extraterrestrial reminds me of, you know, if we were sitting here in the 12th century and we're looking at planets, well, we know planets move in the sky. So what could, if something moves, it has to be pushed by something.
Right.
So there are only two things that could push planets around. That's either angels or devils, right? So you would say, well, half of us would argue that they are pushed around by angels, and the other half would argue they are pushed around by demons. Well, of course, now we've learned that they don't have to be pushed by anything. And we know a lot more about physics, and we understand that the movement of a planet is perfectly natural and is governed by fairly simple laws. And we don't need either angels or demons. Well, it's the same thing here. You know, UFOs are an indication that there is something about space and time that we don't understand. I think it goes beyond that. What the phenomenon really says is that our universe is a subset of something else.
Jacques, stay with us. Just wonderful discussion with you, my friend. We'll be back in a moment. Remote viewer Paul Smith joins us as well. There's a connection here. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.